Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Miles Davis, Nora Jones, The Beatles. Just three reasons to stick around for the next hour. We'll raid the WNYC archives for a rare Miles Davis live performance from 1950. And we'll get some brand new music played live in our studio by the trio called Puss in Boots, which includes the Grammy-winning Nora Jones. We'll also look at the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night 50 years later. But as you may know, we're also looking back this month at the summer of 94.
What's the summer of 94?
We've been asking our guests and you to tell us where you were and what you were listening to during that summer 20 years ago. Now, we sent our intern Haley out into the streets of the West Village to ask a few people what they were listening to 20 years ago. And their answers remind us that not everyone was listening to new music.
My name is Fernando. I was in New York, New York City, Washington Heights area, in Earth, Wind, and Fire.
So my name is Lily, and in 1994 I was actually still back in Kazakhstan, that's where I'm from, and we were a little behind with the music, so in 1994 I was listening to Ace of Base. And what is this guy, Can't Touch This?
Hammer, MC Hammer.
Yeah, MC Hammer, yeah, I remember that.
So my name is Marcel. I lived in Germany at this time and I listened to NoFX. Leave it alone, follow the grain. We couldn't stop the irresistible force. Leave it the same, change with the leaves. Ringing in the sheets, ringing in the old. Leave it alone.
NoFX actually did release this album, Punk and Drublic, in 1994. As for the rest of those folks, well, they were listening to stuff that'd been around for a bit, thanks to our intern Haley Shaw for collecting that sound. So where were you, and what were you listening to that summer 20 years ago? Tell us by leaving a comment at soundcheck.org, or call us at 866-939-1612. We just might use your voice on the radio, too. That number again, 866-939-1612.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log.
Regular Soundcheck listeners might be getting confused about all the anniversaries we're marking this week. The 90th anniversary of our home station WNYC. We've also been doing the 20th anniversary of the summer of 94. Now let's throw in one of those Beatles-related anniversaries, because 1964, 50 years ago, was when the group landed on American soil and set off a cultural revolution as well as a musical one. And one prong in the band's total conquest of the U.S. that year was the film A Hard Day's Night. It was recently restored and re-released in theaters across the country in honor of its 50th anniversary. And to mark that occasion, I'm joined by Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and a frequent contributor to New York Magazine. Matt, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So, when did you first see this movie, Hard Day's Night?
Well, I think I first saw it when I went through my Beatles phase, which I think almost everybody goes through at some point. And I found my way to the Beatles through the Red and Blue albums, the compilations. That was a gateway drug for a lot of Beatles fans. And Hard Day's Night, I had no idea that the Beatles had movies until I started reading about them. And I started with Hard Day's Night, worked my way to Help, Yellow Submarine, mm-hmm. and so forth.
So for folks who haven't seen the film or haven't seen it in a while, the plot, such as it is.
Well, the plot is John, Paul, George, and Ringo play the Beatles. they are the Beatles, and they are having adventures. They're getting in wacky situations and having strange conversations and running away from their screaming fans and occasionally performing music and running and jumping and leaping about.
It's basically, you should pardon the expression, a day in the life of the Beatles.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah. Well, what it really was the United Artists conceived this movie as a kind of a glorified excuse to make money off of a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. They never really imagined that this was going to be anything other than a bit of exploitation. And in fact, the European head of United Artists said before the film came out, whatever money that we lose on distributing this movie, we'll make it back on the soundtrack. Well, to their shock, the film directed by Richard Lester was actually a good movie.
And 50 years later, you know, we're still talking about it, mostly, you know, in a kind of approving way, you know, as opposed to the condescension I expect that United Artists thought they were going to get.
Exactly. Well, in fact, it earned one critic called it the Citizen Kane of jukebox movies, which means that not only was it one of the first successful rock films that was recognized as a piece of legitimate popular art, but it also spawned a critical cliche that we use to this day.
Well, the film is A Hard Day's Night, directed by Richard Lester. It opened in England on July 6th of that summer 50 years ago, 1964. It opened here in the States on August 11th of that year. And, you know, this kind of send-up of the Beatles' fame at the height of Beatlemania, there's a good example of that. When a woman recognizes John Lennon in the hall, and they have this exchange.
Hello. Oh, wait a minute. Don't
no,
tell
I'm
me
not.
Oh, you are.
I'm not.
Oh, you are. I know you are.
I'm not, no.
You look just like him.
Do I? You're the first one that said that ever.
Yes, you do. Look.
No, my eyes are lighter. All right, Noddy.
Oh,
my nose.
Yes. Yes, your nose is very.
Is it?
Well, I would have said so.
Oh, you know him better, though.
I do not. He's only a casual acquaintance.
That's what you say.
What have you heard?
All over the place.
Is it really?
But I wouldn't have it. I stuck up for you.
I knew I could rely on you.
Thanks.
You don't look like him at all.
She looks more like him than I do.
That's still great.
This is 5 years before Monty Python, by the way.
It is, and in fact, listening to that, I'm reminded that the great influence on the Beatles as performers, as actors, is probably the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when you look at them, you really do see a profound Marx Brothers influence, and that was apparent from the very first set of press conferences they did when they went for their first United States tour. These guys were real wits. They were natural on camera. They were very quick. This is a scripted film, but there's obviously a lot of stuff that was either developed out of improvisation or that was improvised, and it feels very loose, and it's got that spirit of not just the Marx Brothers, but also W.C. Fields, Laurel and Hardy, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, and a little Benny Hill as well. I mean,
yes.
You know, there's a couple of kind of sped-up sequences.
There are, and in fact, I think we should mention the director here, Richard Lester. Richard Lester is one of the great sort of unacknowledged influential directors of the last 50, 60 years, and Steven Soderbergh is such a big fan of his that he co-authored a book with him.
Mm.
And Richard Lester did this film called The Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film, which, as you can guess, even if you haven't seen it, you can guess from the title why he was the right choice for Hard Day's Night, because it has a lot of running and jumping and standing still. But the way that he edited it was a really to use that word jukebox again, it just had a jukebox feeling. It had a kind of a, what we would call now a music video feeling, discontinuous editing.
Lots of jump cuts,
but also a celebration of movement, And there's a wonderful quote from Roger Ebert's review of the movie where he says, "The most powerful quality evoked by A Hard Day's Night is liberation." Mm. And, of course, it's a harbinger of the sort of cultural liberation that that would flower in the late 60s, but also a cinematic and artistic liberation, of liberation from some of the constraints of commercial storytelling, that we can make this into a very light, fluffy piece of art.
Mm-hmm. And liberation is the order of the day when the band, having been sort of caught in these claustrophobic confines, you know, the train station,
yes,
the TV studio, they finally break out.
They break out running. Well, and that's how the movie begins. The movie begins with that fantastic, you know, that opening chord of A Hard Day's Night, which is one of the great opening chords in the history of rock and roll. Everybody knows it, and bam, they're running.
Right.
They're running, and
they're running away.
They're running away.
But here in this scene, they're running to this kind of playing field.
Well, they are, and they're leaping, and they're jumping, and the camera's tilting in strange ways, and it's craning up to catch them as they're leaping over the camera, and they're cutting in ways that make them often seem as if they're flying, like they're defying gravity. Again, that idea of liberation.
And the music that they're running and cavorting to is this.
I don't care too much for money. The money can buy me love. Can buy me love. Everybody tells me so. Can buy me love. No, 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 no. Say you don't need no diamond rings and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of thing the money just can't buy.
Buy Me Love from the Beatles. That is the music that they are running and jumping and apparently flying to in that scene sort of late in the movie.
Yes.
Hard Day's Night. We're speaking with Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and contributor to New York Magazine, about A Hard Day's Night, directed by Richard Lester, and now playing once again at the Film Forum here in New York through July 17th. It's been restored and re-released on its 50th anniversary. So you're hearing that song,
yes,
while the band members are running around, but there are other parts of the movie where you hear Beatles songs, and they seemed, actually the famous scene on the train, where they have cards in their hands and then suddenly they have instruments.
Yes.
And so everything is synced, right? It's lip-synced and...
Yeah, everything is synced. I don't think there's a whole lot of live performance in the movie because it wouldn't work in terms of the editing if they shot it that way. But... that said, there is a tremendous sense of fidelity to them as musicians. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like a lot of, I think about these like Frankie Avalon and Ed Funicello beach party films and a lot of the Elvis movies where the people are dancing. They're not even dancing in time to the music. They've got people playing guitars who clearly don't know how to play the guitar, or they're just not bothering. And
right,
it's not that kind of a case. You get the sense that these guys really are musicians. That it's, and you know, of course, they are in real life. But movies don't often respect the fidelity of what they do.
But some of these songs, I mean, "Can't Buy Me Love" had been released earlier in the year.
Yeah.
So, you know, when United Artists said, "Whatever we lose on the movie, we'll make back on the music," they had a kind of a sure thing in their pocket already.
They did. I mean, the Beatles, this was a point in the Beatles' lives where everything they touched turned to gold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just absurd. And you can see, I mean, you know, there's entire books that have been written about. There's a whole book I have on my shelf that's just a list of everything the Beatles did day by day, every day that they were together. And they were the most overscheduled four guys in the history of civilization, probably. Like, only heads of state were as busy as these guys, and they were shooting movies, they were recording albums, and you know, this is maybe or maybe not germane to this film. Maybe it is, because they are running and jumping a lot, and they just seem like they're on fast forward the whole time. But when you look at the fact that they were together for such a brief period of time, and the fact that they made all these films, all these albums, all these singles, they went on tour, and they found time to cultivate individual careers as solo artists that would flower in the 70s, I just can't even fathom how they were able to do everything that they did and have it be good. This movie is good.
That is the thing. How much of a surprise was this? How different is this from all the other music films of the 50s and 60s?
It's enormously influential, particularly for the two go hand in hand, the use of music, the use of pop music and the editing. And they really go together. And what is particularly interesting about it is that it's a kind of a beginning of, again, to invoke Roger Ebert, the semi-obligatory musical interlude, as he calls it, where the film proper almost comes to a halt, and you have this wonderful little enclosed space, almost a dreamlike space. And old movies used to do that, but the segue was a little more graceful. Like, that reminds me of a time last summer when, and then they'll sing a song about the summer.
Right.
And here it's just, bam, suddenly we're into music land, and geography means nothing, time and space mean nothing, and it's just pure movement.
There's also a scene which is a send-up. I mean, you mentioned all the things the Beatles did. They had to make time for the press.
They did.
For meeting the media. And this scene is a send-up of one of the Beatles' press conferences.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
Has success changed your life?
Yes.
I'd like to keep Britain tidy.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
Oh. Have you any hobbies?
No, actually, we're just good friends.
Do you think these haircuts have come to stay?
Well, this one has, you know. Stuck on good and proper now.
It's frankly nice.
What would you call that hairstyle you're wearing?
Arthur.
No, actually, we're just good friends.
You're the brown, aren't they?
What do you call that collar?
A collar.
Oh, do you often see your father?
No, actually, we're just good friends.
How do you like your girlfriends to dress?
That's a little bit more from A Hard Day's Night. You know, it must have been hard. I mean, I've grown up, and I'm sure, Matt, you have too, with, you know, Monty Python and yeah. BBC America and stuff, and we're used to the British accent. For audiences in the 60s, like, the funny line, what do you call that haircut? Yeah. Arthur. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people miss that.
Yes, yeah. I'm a mocker.
I love
that. That's my favorite line in the entire movie. And it's the very slight pause that really makes it. But, yeah, it's funny you should mention the accents because right before the film was released, there were some concerns. An executive at United Artists asked them to perhaps consider redubbing the entire movie. John, Paul, George, and Ringo's voices with, quote, mid-Atlantic accents. Like, in other words, something that was not quite so Liverpoolian. And McCartney supposedly was the one who put the kibosh on that, and he said if they can understand, you know, I'm going to have to leave a word out, but he said if we can understand freaking John Wayne in England, they can understand Liverpool in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they just said no.
And they turned out, again, to be right.
I know. They were right quite a bit, weren't they?
A Hard Day's Night, now 50 years old, restored, re-released, playing at Film Forum through July 17th. We've been speaking with Matt Zoller-Seitz, editor-in-chief at RogerEbert.com, about this great old Beatles classic. Matt, good to talk to you today.
Thank you very much.
Tell me why you cried and why you lied to me.
Next, Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Nora Jones joins us with yet another musical project. This time, she's enlisted two old friends from the New York music scene for a country-fried project called Puss in Boots. The trio plays live next. And later, a live performance from the WNYC archives from Miles Davis. It's true. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck.
Live fast.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The trio known as Puss in Boots consists of three accomplished musicians playing a rootsy brand of folk and country music. Their new record, due next week, is called No Fools, No Fun. And here for a bit of fun is Catherine Popper, Sasha Dobson, and Nora Jones. Collectively, they are Puss in Boots, and they're going to start us off with an original song called 6 Degrees of Separation, live on Soundcheck.
I tried to pretend I don't love you. Tried to make light of it all. In a room full of people we know so well. Tried to pretend they can't tell. But it's worth it for me just to love you. Welcome the lessons that come. 6 degrees of separation. It's just a matter of time. We'll screw our way to salvation. The way to his heart was to leave him. Let the dream fly to the stars. Life has a way of reminding each day the dark and the light of the now. 6 degrees of separation. It's just a matter of time. We'll start to see the big picture. Hearts living free. You're always saying goodbye, love.
That is Puss in Boots, the trio, playing live here in the Soundcheck studio in a song called 6 Degrees of Separation. Let me introduce you to the three members of Puss in Boots. Nora Jones on electric guitar and vocals. Nora, welcome back.
Thank you.
Sasha Dobson on acoustic guitar and vocals, although, Sasha, you'll be heading over to the drum kit shortly, right?
Yes.
All right, good to have you back as well.
Thank you. Nice to
Catherine
be here.
Popper playing the bass and still more vocals. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
So that's some very tight vocal harmonies there, Sasha, but a very elastic kind of melody, too.
True.
That you wrote that song.
Yeah.
So is that how the vocal, like who sings lead, is that how that's done? Whoever writes the song sings lead on it?
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. That's kind of the whole point of this band is that, you know, I think that we're all pretty open to anything. I like that idea of somebody else singing the lead of one of our originals.
Now, Nora, how did you guys first meet and start playing together?
Well, Sasha and I met 15 years ago.
Oh, my God.
When we were sharing. We both,
when we were one. When
I was going to say, were you in like,
we were really
play
young.
School or
something? Pretty young.
We were both sitting in on this jazz gig, and we ended up sharing a jazz gig. We would both do the same gig alternating weekly that summer, and we became friends. And we were pretty good friends for a few years, and then we lost touch for a while. And then when we got back together, we were both into writing songs and not necessarily singing jazz anymore. And Sasha said, hey, I'm trying to learn guitar. You want to learn guitar? I was like, yeah. And she said, okay, I'm booking a gig at a pool hall. And this is around 2004 or five.
Totally.
So she booked a gig at a pool hall every week. And I had been off tour at that time. So we just played in hats and like nobody noticed us at all. And we just kind of stunk it up for a few months. And then we got better.
It's really productive.
It was great.
So there are a lot of covers on this record by Puss in Boots called No Fools, No Fun. There's a great version of the band, of Robbie Robertson of the band, the song Twilight. There's the Neil Young classic Down by the River, a bunch of older sort of country songs. So, you know, how does that repertoire grow out of these evenings misspent in the pool hall?
Basically.
Some of it, yeah.
When did it become like a band and we need to make a record?
Yeah, it only took, what, like 8 years to make a record. I mean, we like she said, we really just kind of played when we were all in town. We'd play at a bar and have fun, and there was very little rehearsal involved. It was more about let's get together and play and have a great time. And over the years, you know, we got better and tighter, and we learned how to sing together even better and better. And last year, Sasha did a CD release for her own album at the Bell House, and so we opened up for her, and they recorded it. And that's what the live recordings are on the album. And when we heard it, we thought, wow, we finally, like, we're a band. We should make a record, you know? And that's that.
And so they have. It's called No Fools, No Fun. The band is Puss in Boots. And Catherine, you've written this next song called Always.
I have.
All right. So, Sasha, I'm going to give you a moment to get behind the drum kit. The members of Puss in Boots are Catherine Popper, playing the guitar, switching from bass to guitar for this one, and singing. Sasha Dobson will still be singing, but this time from behind the drum kit. And Nora Jones, still singing and still playing the electric guitar. They are collectively Puss in Boots. The album's called No Fools, No Fun, and this song is called Always.
You just give me a little yeehaw when you're ready.
Yeehaw! Uh-huh.
Moving kind of slow. Gone, but I don't go. Somehow I'm still here. As I disappear, say you talk. Stay you walk. Maybe I'll come round. Leave without a sound. Follow me. You hate to see me free. You say you talk. You say you walk. It always gets me high. It always gets me home. Most when
top. Stay you walk.
Song's called Always from the trio Puss in Boots, Catherine Popper, Sasha Dobson, Nora Jones playing live here in the studio. And that's from their latest album called, their new album called No Fools, No Fun, which is out next Tuesday. Next Tuesday the 15th, they'll be playing live at the Bell House in Brooklyn, where a couple of tracks from the album have been recorded. And actually, Catherine, you know what I didn't hear in the recorded version, the album version that I heard here live in the studio, was the word it. It always gets me high. It always gets me home. On the record, I was hearing that as always gets me high.
So you dropped your participle or misplaced your modifier.
I just did not hear. I did not hear the pronoun.
Oh my gosh!
So it just struck me as like kind of unusual use of the word always gets me home.
That was so great.
It was, yeah.
It's actually a person named Always.
I'm actually singing about my dog.
Your dog Always.
Feminine product.
All right, let's. This next song is one of Nora's. It's called Don't Know What It Means. It is another live performance by Puss in Boots here in the Soundcheck studio.
Don't know what it means to be me. Hey.
Puss in Boots, live on Soundcheck with Don't Know What It Means. You'll find a version of that on their new album, their debut album, called No Fools, No Fun, when it comes out next week. But you got a chance to hear them playing it live here in the studio. Nora Jones singing, playing electric guitar. Catherine Popper singing, playing bass. Sasha Dobson singing and playing the drums. So, Nora, when you wrote that song, did you write it specifically for this group?
I think I was on tour in Japan, and I wrote it in my dressing room because I had a guitar and an amp in there, and I just turned up really loud. I wasn't necessarily thinking of this group, but I ended up trying it with my band on tour, and it was fine, but it didn't really click until we did it with this band.
Right. I mean, you have so many other things that you do. I mean, when you write a song, do you not always know where it's going to end up?
Yeah, I mean, when I'm writing a song, I guess I'm not really thinking that far ahead, so... Mm. I have written a song for this band before, though, and I ended up doing it on one of my albums because we weren't recording. But, yeah, sometimes it happens where you'll have somebody in mind for it, but sometimes not.
All right. Now, all this month on Soundcheck, we are kind of looking back 20 years to the summer of 1994, and we're asking our guests and our listeners, you know, to tell us where they were, what they were listening to. You know, it was the summer of... OJ and, you know, Kurt Cobain had been found dead, and it was the beginnings of Britpop, and Notorious B.I.G. released his first record.
Wow.
So there's a lot going on.
Amazing.
So, yeah. Sasha, do you remember where you were 20 years ago?
Yeah, 15. I mean, I was pretty much as big of a nerd as I am now, maybe a little bit bigger. I was a real jazz nerd. Because my parents are jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. I blame them for everything. But yeah, I mean, back then it was like all I really wanted to do was sing jazz.
Catherine, how about you?
I think that was my second year in New York, and I'm just trying to remember. I think I remember Dave Vanian from The Damned he played a show at the Limelight with his new band, The Phantom Chords, which was a rockabilly, you know, like psychobilly thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's the only show I remember. But yeah, I was in jazz school, so I mean, I pretty much listened to Sonny Rollins.
We're all
failed jazz.
Good year. Oh my God.
So Sonny Rollins and, oh my God, yeah, Sonny. And I think at that time, too, I was just getting into ECM, you know, and like...
And Nora, please tell me you were not also in jazz school the summer of 94.
I very much was. Oh my gosh. I went to a performing arts high school, and my focus was jazz piano. And then that summer, I went to... an arts camp, and my focus was jazz piano, so I was knee deep in jazz. But yeah, it's funny, I was listening to way older music then, but I also was into Nirvana and like the Violent Femmes in junior high school. But yeah, I listened to Bill Evans and Billie Holiday pretty much nonstop.
All right. Well, a nice summer, it sounds like, for all of you, 20 years ago, the summer of 94. But the three members of Puss in Boots have other things on their mind now. The album No Fools, No Fun is coming out next week. They'll be playing on the 15th release day at the Bell House in Brooklyn. They've been playing for us live here in the Soundcheck studio today. Catherine Popper, Sasha Dobson, Nora Jones, to the three of you, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The jazz fanatics of Puss in Boots will like what we have coming up next. In honor of the 90th birthday of our home station, we'll dip into the WNYC archives to listen to an on-air appearance by the great Miles Davis. Next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This week marks 90 years of broadcasting here at our home station, WNYC Radio, and some pretty remarkable musical moments have happened on this station during those 9 decades. This week we're listening back to performances and interviews with artists like Bob Dylan, Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, and today, Miles Davis. Back in 1950, WNYC broadcast his performance at the American Music Festival, which was something we did every year, usually in February. And joining me in the studio to tell us more about it is Ashley Kahn, music historian and author of the book Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. Ashley, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Always a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you.
Were you, you've heard this tape of February 18th, 1950. The American Music Festival that year took place at Birdland.
Right.
What did you think of these tapes?
Well, I loved it. I mean, you know, if you look at the personnel on the, you know, who's playing on these tracks, it's really an incredible, you know, I mean, it's the future all-stars, you know, the future headliners of where modern jazz was going at the time. And 1950 was definitely a very pivotal, just as bebop is giving way to hard bop and trying to figure out, well, what do we do with all this new vocabulary that's been established by, you know, Bird and
right.
Dizzy,
so
et cetera.
Bebop had come to the fore in the 40s.
That's right.
With much more, you know, improvisatory flair. You know, you'd have your chord changes, but then you'd go like, you know.
I mean, the more aerial view of it really is that jazz was in the midst. It wasn't just a stylistic change. It was a conceptual change in that jazz was becoming a soloist's art.
Right.
It wasn't just about big band, dance and accompaniment and, you know, social accompaniment stuff. It was really where the soloist would step out and the people would sit and listen.
Right. And then in the 50s, you have hard bop, but you also have the cool, you know, the birth of the cool, which the Miles Davis record, which we can talk about in a moment. So where were those two? How did those two parallel threads happen?
Well, they're basically, you know, two branches on the same tree. And the root really is this sort of modernist sensibility that, you know, came from the seeds that had been sown in the 1940s, courtesy of Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, etc., these, you know, very gung-ho soloists.
And so in this recording from the American Music Festival on WNYC in 1950, we have some of the young lions of jazz.
That's right.
All coming to, I mean, it's Miles Davis, Stan Getz on tenor sax, Art Blakey on drums, J.J. Johnson on trombone, Tad Dameron on piano. All of these guys would go on to be, like, you know, enormous figures in their own right. Gene Ramey, who played with Monk.
That's right. Gene Ramey, who was part of this whole revolution that was going on.
So this is an amazing group. And here they are from this WNYC archive recording from February 18th, 1950. Miles Davis and an all-star lineup with Stan Getz on sax, Art Blakey on drums, J.J. Johnson on trombone, Tad Dameron on piano, Gene Ramey on bass, recorded live at Birdland during WNYC's American Music Festival, the 1950 edition. And that's Miles Davis and company playing Chance It, also known as Max is Making Wax. which Charlie Parker, who you mentioned before, Ashley, recorded a number of times.
That's right. And it's a Howard McGhee composition, I believe we found out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which kind of points to the idea that there was a certain looseness and sharing of resources and of the, you know, the spirit of the time. All these guys were the new generation cats.
Yeah.
They weren't big headliners like Duke and, you know, Pops and
Pops being Louis
Pops
Armstrong.
Being Louis Armstrong and Count Basie. I mean, these were the big headliners of the day, of course.
Although Max is making wax, is that a reference to the great late Max Roach?
Absolutely.
The drummer?
Absolutely.
So where was Miles in his career at the time of this music that we're hearing?
You know, Miles had made a splash already. He was one of the leading trumpeters to come out of this bebop era, along with, you know, a bunch of other young, you know, innovators and people who had just arrived on the New York scene. Of course, the difference with Miles is he had already been on the scene for about 5 years, because he arrives in 45 from St. Louis and goes straight to Juilliard and starts his studies there. But his real studies, of course, begin on 52nd Street and up in Harlem with Charlie Parker by his side, recording with Bird, and then starting to record under his own name.
Mm-hmm.
1950 is very interesting because we hear him playing very straight-ahead bebop stuff, but at the same time, what he's going to become known for is the birth of the cool.
Right. And at the same time that that this recording was being made, he's already started to record that album, The Birth of the Cool.
Well, it's actually a collection of 78 sides, and later it's collected as an album.
Right.
You know, and it's, and in fact, when he does record it, and of course it's, I mean, you listen to it, it's very studied. It's really got that Gil Evans-ish touch. You know,
the subtle orchestration and stuff like that.
Almost like a subtle references to you know, modern classical influences coming over from Europe. It was basically the Claude Thornhill big band where a lot of these cats were coming out of, and Miles himself was a huge fan
of Claude Thornhill.
You know, and so that's going on the side. And he's kind of like saying, well, I'm hearing this bebop stuff, but I'm also hearing this cool sound. Right. Later, it's dubbed, by the way, Birth of the Cool, you know, because cool jazz becomes popular.
Right.
When Miles is doing it, it doesn't even have a name.
So he's making he's cutting these sides in 49 and 50 around the time of this performance, but the album doesn't come out till 57.
Well, actually, the 10-inch comes out in 53, I believe, 53, 54 in Capitol. But the sides themselves, the 78 sides, Moonrise and various other tunes, do start to have a mark on the jazz scene, more, you know, on the musicians than on as far as a popular impact.
Yeah.
It becomes... The popular impact hits when, as you say, is collected within an album kind of format.
And that is when?
Well, 54 with the 10-inch, and then later 56, I think, 56, 57 with the 12-inch.
With the 12-inch, okay.
Yeah.
Ashley Kahn's with us here in the Soundcheck studio, music historian, NYU professor, and I think probably the last time, Ashley, you were on Soundcheck was when you did the book, Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. We are talking about this 90th anniversary week and some of the gems in the WNYC archives, including this 1950 American Music Festival performance by Miles Davis. Ashley, you mentioned Claude Thornhill, Miles Davis being a fan of his. He's clearly also aware of another pianist composer, George Shearing.
George Shearing, absolutely. Another modernist, a guy who's listening very intensely to the, you know, inventions of Bud Powell, of Thelonious Monk, and taking it further. Again, you know, I think the best way of describing it is there's this new language that's been invented. What do we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everyone's asking. And of course, if you think about the whole 1950s with cool, with hard bop, with the coming of modal jazz and Kind of Blue, etc., it's all this kind of effort by different people, Dave Brubeck, Charles Mingus, eventually Ornette Coleman. What do we do with what's been invented in the 1940s? And all of these recordings are like examples of, you know, what's going to be done by this very, very tight brotherhood of players.
Yeah. So during this performance at our American Music Festival, Miles and company play this George Shearing piece called Conception.
Indeed.
Let's hear it. Called Conception. It's a George Shearing tune played by Miles Davis and his all-star lineup. February 18th, 1950 at WNYC's annual American Music Festival, the 1950 edition taking place uptown at Birdland. Ashley Kahn, the music historian and author, is here with me in the Soundcheck studio, and all this week we're celebrating 90 years of broadcasting history here at WNYC. So there's Miles and Stan Getz and Art Blakey and all the rest, and doing a fairly straightforward version of Conception. I was going to say, well, he never recorded this, but he did, kind of, right?
That's right.
Tell us the story of Deception.
Well, Deception is one of the birth of the cool tunes, and you know they were reaching not only for ideas and concepts of what to do with this bebop language, but also material. And anyone like a Tad Dameron or a Thelonious Monk or Bud Powell who were inventing these new tunes that would become the standards, the new standards, mm-hmm. if you will, of this generation, Conception is definitely one of those. It was hip. It used a bebop kind of feel, but at the same time, it took a little bit more in a sophisticated direction.
So Deception is a very different sounding version of Conception, the piece
yes.
that we just heard.
Yes.
And here is the version that you might know from the record Birth of the Cool. It was actually recorded less than a month later. It was March 9th of 1950, and as it happens, at another radio studio in New York at WOR, and here's how it sounded. Miles Davis from the Birth of the Cool, a collection of works recorded in 1949 and 1950. The album, the 12-inch, wouldn't be released till 1957, though, as Ashley Kahn tells us, these individual tracks were already making a mark on jazz. Deception is what we just heard. It is a version of the George Shearing piece Conception that we heard just a moment ago from the American Music Festival. So this is like a great little set that we have.
Indeed.
Has this been heard? I mean, do people know about this? Is there
Well, there's a lot
of
like
collectors out
there. I mean, within that, you know, the Milesologists, you know, it's definitely a popular moment, shall we say. You know, definitely anything that is before Miles hurt his vocal cords and he's making stage announcements and you can hear his voice being very clear and whatnot is very special to a lot of people, too.
What did he do to his voice?
He got into an argument with some, you know, house manager. I think it was at Birdland, as a matter of fact. And he had just had polyp surgery. And he just aggravated, and had permanent scarring.
Wow. Ashley Kahn's been with us as we've been looking back and digging through our WNYC archive, celebrating 90 years of broadcasting this week. You can check out more great audio from WNYC's archives as part of our 90th anniversary programming online at WNYC.org/90. Ashley, good to see you again.
Always, John. Thanks for having me.
On the show, as part of our Summer of 94 retrospective, we hear about Ready to Die, the game-changing debut LP from rap legend Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. the Notorious B.I.G. Plus, live music from the New York electronic duo Tiny Victories. Our Summer of 94 theme song was produced by our engineer Paul Schneider and was sung by Tim Rudiman of the Dexter Lake Club Band. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.